Hello, this is Josh Anderson, CAS, with another episode of In Conversation. Production sound mixer Peter Kirlin, CAS, shouldn't require an introduction. He's been nominated for 4 Academy Awards for Best Sound Mixing, nominated for 4 BAFTAs, winning 1, nominated for 5 CAS Awards, winning 3 times, and has won 2 Grammys, including Album of the Year in 2002 for his work on O Brother, Where Art Thou? Peter has a long history with the Coen brothers, going back to working as a boom operator on their first feature film, Blood Simple, and eventually transitioning to full-time production sound mixer. In addition to his 40 years in production sound, Peter currently serves as the president of CAS, is the business representative for IATSE Local 492 in Nashville, and is a co-owner of the Performing Arts Theater, the Dark Horse Theater, also in Nashville. Welcome, Peter, and thank you for taking the time to join me in conversation.
I don't know, it sounds like I won Album of the Year, and actually I've won as an engineer on the Album of the Year. I mean, 175 of us won, so, but I appreciate
That's a lot.
It.
Well, great. How you doing?
Good.
Good, good. So I guess, I'd love to start off with how did you get into production sound?
I guess, my wife and I were doing work in theaters around town, and she did a set design for a little tiny theater downtown in a building that my mother operated called Goodies. And we were upstairs building the set, and a location manager came in downstairs and said to my mother, "Hey, do you know anybody who wants to be a PA on a TV movie?" And she said, "Oh, you should speak to, my son and daughter-in-law. They're just upstairs." And we spoke to her, and she sent us in for interviews. And when I went in there, I asked to be an art PA. And they said, "Well, do you know anything about movie sound?" And I said, "No." And they said, "Do you know what an Agra is?" And I said, "I have no idea." And they said, "Great, you're the new sound PA." So I worked on that show with a great mixer named Gary Alper, and it was, for all intents and purposes, a musical, and he was inventing technology as we went to do the music, and I ended up being very involved in that, and I found it fascinating, and I stuck with it.
Nice.
Then the same person, the same location manager, became the first AD on Blood Simple, and she asked my wife, who was working with her in locations, to be her third AD, and invited us down to Texas, where they were shooting Blood Simple, and I didn't have a job lined up, but when they started, it turned out they didn't have a boom operator, and the day before the filming started, I got introduced to Lee Orloff, who is the sound mixer, and they sort of tested me around the room using a closet pole to see if I could keep a microphone in front of somebody, and I got hired as a boom operator, which started a very long friendship with Lee Orloff, who is currently the CAS treasurer, which is very funny for us, and he and I worked together for years with me boom operating.
What were your interests sort of before getting into, I guess, the theater work and then eventually the film work?
Well, I guess looking back, I always had an interest in film. When I was in middle school, I made a lot of 8mm movies. I actually made a couple of soundtracks for these movies, which was, I think, not typical amongst my classmates. So I always kind of liked film. I was much more involved in theater, and I did a lot of theater stuff. Some as doing sets or props, but also some doing sound for theater, which at that time was mostly playing back effects and music and not so much voice amplification. So those skills sort of came in handy. And I did a lot of other stuff. I was a firefighter, and I did construction, and I did a bunch of things, but that was sort of the one that stuck.
As you were starting out, what were you learning from mixers like Gary and Lee?
Well, I mean, on Living Proof, the TV movie I did, there was a boom operator, Mark John Sullivan, who was really great, and I watched him work a lot, and I got an idea of what he did, but I never really got a chance to do it, but I watched him. And then when I started working with Lee, Lee had, a way he wanted things recorded and where he wanted the microphone and a style of working that I picked up. And, at that time, almost everything was on the boom. And so, we relied very heavily on that. And he pushed me to become a better boom operator and helped me do that. And that served us really well for a bunch of years. I also learned from him a lot of technical stuff about maintaining equipment and about, what the right things to use are and different alternatives, including, accidentally dropping the head of his Sheps in the mud on one movie, which later on, when somebody dropped mine, the same way, I couldn't be angry at them. And, and Lee and I went on to do a lot of low-budget movies, a lot of educational films, one of which we did a film called Starlight, which was a musical about a kid's summer camp that was all songs all the way through it. And, Lee had particular techniques and equipment to use for that, which were very helpful for me. And later on, when I started mixing, I did a lot of musicals, and the stuff that I learned from Gary and from Lee, and also from Alan Beyer, I used a lot. I still use a lot of their techniques and some of my own.
After you worked with Lee on Blood Simple, Alan Beyer was the sound mixer for a lot of those early Coen brother films. How did you two meet?
We met, I did Blood Simple and had a really good time. And I think that the Coens liked me and wanted to work with me. But when they decided to do Raising Arizona, they hired primarily a union crew out of New York. And at that time, you know, the New York crews traveled. And so I didn't get hired. And so Lee and I were doing a movie for David O. Russell. It was like his first movie. It was this very, very low budget short film called Bingo Madness that we were doing in the basement of a church. And I got a call saying, hey, you know, we're looking to make a change in boom operators. Are you willing to come to Arizona? Which was a little awkward because Lee didn't get called to go. And I kind of felt bad about it, but he was very nice about it and said I was welcome to go. And I did. And my plane got delayed overnight due to weather. And by the time I got there in the morning, Alan had left the job temporarily because of a death in his family. And so when I showed up on the set, they hadn't let go of the other boom operator because they needed him. And I instead showed up mixing, and I didn't have a lot of experience mixing then. So I mixed for a couple of days, and then we brought somebody in to mix, and I started boom operating then. And then, you know, several days later, Alan showed up, and, you know, I was already sort of embedded in the movie, and Alan showed up, and we worked together fine. Very little conversation. The kind of microphones that he used were the same as Lee used. You know, his mixer was different, which was a little hard to get used to, but I wasn't mixing, so I couldn't help set up as much as I had before. But we got to know each other really well and did many movies together.
Did you notice a difference between Gary, Lee, and Alan in how they worked?
Well, Gary was a very good mixer, but he didn't take the movie very seriously. I don't think anybody did. It was a TV movie, and we were doing the best we could. He did a great job, but I think it was like, it seemed like instinctive that he just knew what to do. And I guess he thought about it a lot. And I'm thinking about it now, and I didn't know anything at that time. So everything he did was kind of magic to me. Lee was used to doing low budget sound. And so he had this package that was sort of in a bunch of different cases for him to travel all over the world doing documentaries and stuff. And so there was a lot of setting up to do and a lot of hauling things around. And Alan kind of had all of his stuff together. You know, he was already, you know, a feature mixer. And Lee and I were kind of learning features together. And Alan was much more established. But their style of working was very similar. At that time, a lot of people's style was similar. Everything was on the boom. Radio mics were somewhat rudimentary. And we were lucky that almost everything was single camera. So that made booming, you know, much more possible.
Usually a two-person crew at that time?
It was a two-person crew with Lee most of the time. Later on, particularly on movies like The Abyss, which we did together, that I didn't boom operate the whole thing, but we brought in a utility to help with the underwater stuff, and then that person was available when we were topside. But it was not typical to have a third person. Alan and I had a variety of people, sound PAs, a woman named Jean Carroll, who became our utility for many shows, but it was not, for us, on the kind of movies we were doing, it wasn't typical at the time to have a utility. Now I won't work without one. And in fact, you know, later on I did a fairly low budget movie, and I paid to have Jean Carroll come in out of my pocket because I just couldn't work without her. And since then, it's become much easier for me to get a utility.
As a boom operator, which other mixers were you working with?
Doug Axtell. I did this movie Hoosiers as a boom operator, which you can actually see me in. And in another place, you can see the boom pretty clearly. I did those with David Brownlow. So I worked with a number of people when I was boom operating.
What was it about booming that you did enjoy?
I liked being on the set. I liked being in the middle of things, being able to speak for the sound department, be able to see how the movie was being made. All that stuff as a boom operator was really great because you're just standing there, you know, next to the camera all the time. And it's a much better way to interface with the directors because you're right there next to them. So I really liked that part of it. I liked going home and being done for the day and not having to worry about it. There was a lot of stuff that I knew that mixers dealt with that I didn't have to deal with, and I was very appreciative of that. And later on, when I started mixing, I got to really appreciate that, you know, all those times where I got phone calls at 3 a.m. saying, you know, how come all the dailies are blank? And I would have to explain, you know, for 2 hours, explain to them how to retrieve the audio. I could still do without that part. But I do miss being on the set. And I try very hard to get my cart very near the set so that I can actually have a conversation or I get an eye line with the director so that if there's an issue, they can just look over at me and I can give them a look and they know whether it's good or bad. But, you know, working with Randy and Steve, they knew if it was good or bad, and so they could do the same thing. So it wasn't critical that I do that. I just sort of missed doing that for myself. On the other hand, boom operators always are a filter for the mixer. And so I could be back on the private lines saying, this is horrible. They got to cut. This is horrible. This is horrible. And, you know, and then I could hear Randy saying, could you turn off the fan? And then they turn off the fan and everything would be fine. So boom operators are very good as a filter. I was not a good filter either as a boom operator. I remember, you know, there was a scene in Hudsucker Proxy where we were looking square on into a glass window. And we had a radio mic, but it was not sounding like it wanted to. We had a bunch of plant mics out on this long conference table. But, you know, Alan was very determined it should be a boom scene. It was really the only way to do it. And you could see everything in the room. The camera was all behind a big black curtain. All the rest of the crew was behind the big black curtain, but I had to have a boom sticking out of it and I had to be able to see where the boom was. And I guess I was, as a boom operator, I wasn't in a position to back off. And so I didn't. And eventually, they had to take the center of the glass window out, which worked perfectly for my purposes. But every time I see that movie, I can see that the glass is missing. And it just makes me cringe. I keep thinking one of these days I will, you know, I'll apologize to Roger Deakins about it. But he may not remember because we've worked together for, you know, a decade or more since I stopped booming. And I think now he thinks of me as a mixer and not that kid who made his shot terrible.
That's a great story.
You know, I liked the work that I did as a boom operator. I thought I did pretty well. And one of the things I like to do as a boom operator is problem solve. So on each one of these movies, there was, you know, some variety of problems that we had to figure our way through and did. And I felt very much a part of the team, which I appreciated. But, you know, at a certain point in there, I had been working with a director of photography named Barry Sonnenfeld, who then went on to become a director. And when he started directing, he asked me if I would mix for him. And, you know, I was very honored. I hadn't mixed very many things at that point, you know, mostly small things, but he had confidence in me and gave me confidence in myself. And so I started, I started mixing with, you know, Adam's Family. And then we did a Michael J. Fox movie after that. And it seemed to be, I was comfortable mixing. I liked it. There were some challenges, but at that point I was pretty confident, which was good because I was very prone to using new equipment that people weren't used to. And it required a lot of, for lack of a better word, chutzpah, to go in there and say, well, this is how I do it, and I don't care how you've always done it. I don't know how easy that would be to do now, but since then, there's been a lot of technological change. But anyway, so I started mixing for myself, but the Coens still wanted me as a boom operator, and I worked with Alan on a number of projects on and off, and I liked boom operating, and so when I didn't have a mixing job with Barry, and he, after we'd finish a movie, Barry and I, he'd be in a cutting period for months and months and months. And so he'd have, you know, it might be 6 months or a year before his next project. So it timed out very well that when I wasn't doing a movie with him, I would go back and do a Coen movie. And they had a year between projects. And so I could do both. And then the last movie I did as a boom operator was Big Lebowski. And I think at that point, Alan had another boom operator who he liked working with. And he and I didn't always see eye to eye on things. So about halfway through the job, I left and his other boom operator, who he had brought in as a second boom, just took over. And then when they were setting up to do Oh Brother, they called me and they said, look, you know, we like Alan, everything is good, but this is a musical and we really want somebody who, that's what they do is musicals. And I said, well, that's great, because I would love to do that. And so that's when I started mixing for the Coens. And I did very little boom operating after that. I think I worked with Steve Bowerman he was a boom operator with me for a long time. And he started mixing. And I on one of his projects, I boomed. And I boomed for Glenn True once when he was recovering from a motorcycle accident. But that's about it. The rest of the time I was mixing after that. And I liked it. I mean, the first thing I discovered as a mixer was that every other boom operator was better than I had been. And so, you know, when I met Steve Bowerman on Adam's Family, it was like, wow, look at all this stuff that he can do that it never occurred to me I could do this shot. And he always was in the right place and everything sounded great. And it took all the pressure off. And at that point, it was hard for me to go back to boom operating because I recognized that he was much better than I was. And after that, I was working with John Fundis and then Randy Johnson, and they were all much better boom operators than I was. And so it made my job as a mixer easy, but it also made it impossible to go back to a job that I knew I couldn't do as well as they did.
Mm.
I think what I learned most of all is hire the best boom operator you can get, somebody who you can trust, somebody who has an ear for the dialogue and understands the way that you work, and then, you know, spend the rest of your career working with them. Because That's the best thing. You know, even with really good mixers, like Lee, who taught me, oh, here's where it sounds good. This is where you want the boom. That was incredibly valuable. But then once I learned that, you know, I don't necessarily need somebody, you know, looking over my shoulder and saying, hey, it looks like you could be 2 inches down, or, you know, that wasn't helpful to me. And, you know, and mixers who come on set and say, you know, put the boom here. When you're mixing, you don't get that sense of here's where the lighting instruments are, and this is what the actor is going to do, and this is what the director just whispered to me about the dialogue they do and don't want. And so, you know, you have to give boom operators the room to do the job that they know how to do. And I try to always do that as a mixer. And once Video Assist came into the picture, where it was really easy to see whether the boom was in or out, you know, I'll help a boom operator. If they ask, they'll say, hey, can you give me a line? I can look and say, here's where the line is. But then it's not my job to tell them to ride that line. If I know they're trying to, and I know the lens has changed and they didn't notice it, which is very rare, I can say, hey, you know, you have another 6 inches. And usually the response to that is, yeah, but then I'll get a shadow across their forehead, or, you know, or leave me alone. Some, you know, an appropriate response. And so I'm pretty good about staying out of that. And I don't think I would have felt that so much if I hadn't spent all those years boom operating. There's a lot to boom operating. You know, you have to know all the lenses. You have to know the camera operator's style and how they frame. You have to know what the director wants. All this on top of the script. And what I learned as a boom operator is that you can spend all night memorizing the script. But when it comes right down to it, if you're watching the actors and you're following their performance, you know who's going to speak. And it's not going to be necessarily what their next line is. It's going to be when they feel compelled to speak and there's a look in their eyes or they make a motion or something that gets them to go there. And so I often find myself, you know, pointing the microphone at somebody who is not whose line it is. And then they speak. I did have a couple of experiences where I was following the script and I made a mistake. And, you know, it's the poor actor staying there and suddenly the boom is in their face and they're going, because they know they don't have anything to say, but they think they should because they figure I know the script better than they do, which was not always the case, though often.
Do you miss being so tied to the performance that way?
Oh, yeah. And I still spend most of my time when I'm mixing, watching on the monitor and seeing what they're doing and seeing what the performance is. And I try to set up somewhat near where the director or directors are so I can hear what the notes are. So I still try to stay pretty tied up in it. And that's important because, you know, you might miss where the director says, okay, on this one, why don't you scream out your second line? That's an important thing to know. And it's an important thing also to be able to tell the mixer if the mixer didn't hear it, so they're prepared.
When you were then sort of just getting introduced with Steve and with Randy, did they come in as like recommendations or did you?
I think, I'm trying to remember, and I'll probably get this wrong, but I believe that when I went to do Adam's Family, I knew who Jeff Wexler was, and I was always impressed with the movies that he did. And I knew he always worked with Don Soufle, and they did a great job. And so, if I remember correctly, I think I tried to hire Don Soufle, and Jeff was understandably annoyed, although I didn't understand how that relationship worked at that time because I didn't have a long-term relationship with the boom operator. And Don just said, hey, you know, you should call Steve. And I did, and I met him for the first time on set for our first scene together, and I was a little intimidated because he'd done a ton more work than I had. It was my first movie as a mixer. It was my first real movie as a mixer, and I didn't want to be telling him what to do. He knew what to do. And so I sort of laid back, and he did amazing things. And he knew stuff like, I don't know, the very first scene we did was a scene where Pugsley and Wednesday are going to school, and Morticia comes out with a bag with their lunch in it. And the gag was that there was a machine in there that made the bag rustle. They're eating something live for lunch is the joke.
Right.
And, you know, he knew stuff like, hey, you know, they make rubber bags that don't rattle. And you could put something in the bag to make the machine quieter. I mean, he knew stuff like that. It never occurred to me. And I said, what are we going to do? And he said, oh, I'll take care of it. And he did. And there were so many instances of that. The stuff that he knew, and he knew the other people on the crew really well. We were working in the studios in Los Angeles, and I'd done very little work in the studios because the Coen movies I did as a boom operator in California were fairly low budget independents. But, you know, Steve knew everybody, and Randy knows everybody in the universe. And so you can't go on a set with Randy without them all running over and saying, hey, Randy, what can I do for you? And hey, you need a flag. And, you know, it's kind of an amazing thing. I had the same experience with John Fundis in New York. I mean, now he just retired from being the vice president business agent of the local there. But even when he was a boom operator, everybody knew him, everybody knew his father, everybody was used to working with him. And he most boom operators are quiet and they, you know, they discreetly ask somebody for something. And, you know, and John's way was, hey, fellas, come over here right now and solve my problem. And they would come over and do it. It was just how they worked with him. Very different than anybody else, but it was very effective. And it's, again, it wasn't just where to put the microphone. All these boom operators knew a lot more about how to deal with the rest of the crew than I did. So that was good, too.
Was there a quality or attribute or something you were looking for from your boom operators? As a former boom operator, was there something you recognized?
I think mostly it's their ear and the fact that we knew what we wanted to sound like and they knew where to put the microphone to make that happen. And they also knew how to manage the set in a really positive way. And I often say that my secret weapon is laziness, and that if the boom operator can figure out how to do everything, then I can sort of sit and worry about something else and not worry about where the microphone is or where the background noises are coming from. And both, well, all of them, but particularly Ranny and Steve, I didn't have to worry about anything. You know, if there was something that could be done, they would do it. And they introduced me to putting rugs down and to, in the prep at the beginning of the day, you know, to well in advance go and find all the noise-making stuff, to go into a restaurant and find everything to turn off and remember to turn it back on. I mean, I do that now instinctively, but I kind of learned that from them. You know, they were trained by a whole bunch of boom operators before them and mixers. They work with tons of mixers, many of whom I'm sure are more skilled and experienced than I am. And so I take advantage of what they learned. And now I know some of it and I've conveyed it to other people.
I'm curious if you feel like you use a lot of EQ now, but when you were boom operating, did the mixers you worked with use a lot of EQ? Did you learn about EQing from them?
A little bit. I mean, I would hear, I mean, Alan did a lot of, not a lot, but he did a significant amount of EQing. I don't know if Lee did or not, but Lee didn't even use a mixer for the first many movies we did together. You know, everything was recorded straight into the Nagra or through a Nagra's little BMT mixing device. Alan did a little bit. He could make the radio mic sound better. He spent a lot of time EQing radios, not so much EQing the boom, but, you know, to make stuff match. And it was really important then because he was recording to mono. And, you know, if you try to mix between boom and radio, you really had to make it mix well. So I learned a little bit from that. But, you know, honestly, the relationship between me and EQ is a very short story. I use almost no EQ. And because there's ISO tracks, it's possible in post that they can tweak up the EQ to match better than I had it on set. I'll do a little bit to try to make the lavs match a little bit, but I don't want to go too far because I always think of it this way. I have a limited amount of time and concentration on the set to do it, and I'm never in a good listening environment. And the people in post have not all the time in the world, but they have a lot more time, and they have better equipment, and they're in a quiet room. So for them to adjust the EQ makes a lot more sense. I remember once doing a shot in a car, and this was I think, on that Michael J. Fox movie, For Love or Money. I remember turning down a lot of low end because we were in the car and it was really rumbly and we were doing a stunt and it really sounded rumbly. And so I kept turning it down. And then when the car pulled over and we stopped and I listened to it back, it was thin because I was hearing all that low frequency twice, once through my headphones and once around the headphones from the car. And it was really hard to judge. And I just overdid it. And I thought, well, there's no reason to do that. I just cut off enough to make it record properly and then let somebody else deal with it later on. And that's largely been my philosophy. I feel sort of the same way about most noise reduction, which is I could have noise reduction on set, but since I mostly do feature films and since mostly there's an extended cutting and mixing period afterwards, somebody can take the noise out. The only reason I need to think about noise reduction is to just know whether it'll work. And sometimes I'll take a parametric or some other kind of filter and see if I can filter the noise out. And if it seems to be coming out, then I turn off that notch because I know it can be done. And I can say to the director, yes, this dialogue can be salvaged. It may have a little bit of noise in dailies, but it'll be fine ultimately. It's an educated guess, but it's a guess, but I can experiment a little bit. But I'd much rather do that than carve a chunk of the audio out and then find out later on it was too much or, you know, it took out some of the dialogue as well.
Since it was mostly single camera when you were boom operating, how were you handling overlaps and how much say did you have about it on set?
Alan had, you know, because we started working with Gene, you know, Alan had this approach, which is, you know, mic all the off-camera lines. If there was going to be overlap, he'd much rather have Gene stand off screen with the other actors so that if there was an overlap, he'd have a second track of it, particularly once he started recording with a stereo Nagra. That was a great technique, and I always use that now. It's so much easier to do that than to tell the actor and the director, hey, you can't overlap. And that miking all the off-screen stuff, for a lot of actors, their best performances are off-screen. And so if you've preserved that as well, that gives a choice. And then they can either play off screen or they can lay the off screen line, you know, onto their close up, and it pretty much fits, but it's a good performance. And often better mic'd, because as long as you can get away from the camera enough, you know, you can have the microphone wherever you want it. Whereas if you're trying to mic them on screen, you know, you're having to be much wider than you normally would be.
Would you try to match the distance of the off-screen mic with the on-screen mic?
Try to be roughly where their close-up would be. Not any tighter, because then it starts to sound, you know, too present or tubby. But generally, how it would match their close-up, which is, you know, in my experience, that ends up being most of the dialogue that's used. Unless there's no close-up shot. On the wide shots, the editors and the sound editors who I've worked with have a tendency to just cut the close-up track together and use that in the wide shots. So those are always what I try to get to be the consistent sound for the scene. It may be a little different if there's shots that play mostly in the wide shot or that they need perspective on them. You know, I guess they'll use that track as well. You know, again, I'm going for the close-up sound, not close like a voiceover, but, you know, sort of typical overhead boom distance. That's the sound as I like to hear it in my head. I kind of have this idea of what I want it to sound like. And so I just try to match that as best as I can.
Does that come from, is that film specific? Does it come from the script, or is that sort of a general?
It's a general thing. And I think I learned it booming. I think, you know, when you're booming, certainly American boom operators, you can't always see where the microphone is, but you can hear where it is. And so I just got to think the boom is now exactly in the right spot. This is a sweet spot, and I like the sound of that. And so that becomes my standard. Even when I'm mixing, I know I want it to sound like that. And boom operators, including myself, hate it when you tell them, oh, put the microphone here or put it there, because they've got enough to think about. But I will say, hey, can you be a little bit tighter, or that sounds too close, or go off axis a little bit, you know, because I know what I want. You know, one of the great things about working with, you know, Randy for so many movies is I never have to say that to him. He knows exactly what we both want to sound like, and it's the same thing. I should go back and say this about boom operating. When I was a boom operator and I was full of myself, I thought to myself, hey, this is a big piece of the sound. You know, boom operating is like where all this sound comes from. And then when I became a mixer, then I really felt that way. I felt like the control I have as a mixer is I can record or forget to record. I can make decisions about other tracks. I can set levels to a point, though I try not to do a lot of level riding. But all of it comes from the boom operator. And so if you can help them get what they need, then they can provide the whole soundtrack, basically. And only when you're in a really bad spot where you need a lot of radio mics or you need multiple booms and you're fading between them, the rest of the time it's just sitting there watching the meters bounce up and down.
What qualities do you feel you get from a boom microphone that you don't get from a lavalier?
Well, there's a couple of things. One, there's a psychoacoustic thing that your brain hears something different than what your ears do. And it has to do with if you see something that's wide, it sounds normal for it to sound wide. And so when you're in a movie theater and you're looking at the screen, you expect things to sound, in your head, you expect them to sound a particular way. And if it doesn't, I find it disconcerting. The boom is much better about that. The boom allows you to mix in the air. So if you've got two people talking at once, or you've got people talking amongst themselves, the boom will allow that to mix itself largely and sound really good, as opposed to trying to catch them at the right moment on the faders, and then you get phasing or whatnot. I mean, there's ways to avoid that, but it's so much easier if it's all happening in real time. And the boom will give you a sense of ambience and the room, which ultimately that's what people want for almost all movies, is a sense of that, and they can recreate that in post, and often they do, and for good reason. But if they don't have to, it's really nice to have that be part of the track. It also picks up a lot of production effects that you won't necessarily get on the radio. And whether you think that's valuable or not, I guess it depends on how you do the effects for your movie. It's different in TV. You know, there's this big discussion now about dialogue intelligibility, and there's a lot of reasons for that. But I think part of it is that you're looking at a screen up close with a little tiny speaker on it. And if the dialogue is not super present, it doesn't reproduce it well, and you don't hear it well. And it doesn't convey the same dynamic range that it does in a movie theater. So, you know, in the TV world, a lot more radios, you know, sort of more necessary or more acceptable, particularly if you shoot multiple cameras and everything is shot with a close-up and a wide shot at the same time, then, you know, the only way you're going to get intelligible audio is on a radio mic, which is unfortunate.
Do you feel like there's a vocal performance quality that you get from the boom microphone?
Well, certainly there's a voice quality that I think is much better on the boom. It sounds much more natural to my ear. it doesn't require EQing, which is if I use a radio, I almost always have to take out a little tubbing. And I said I don't use EQ, but on a radio, I take out a little tubbiness. I add in a little bit of the high end, which you get lost given the position. And that's all trying to make a close approximation of what it would have been on the boom. Whereas if you do it on the boom in the first place, you get that natural sound of the voice. And I like that particularly with a, you know, with a really good microphone. And you're able to mic across the voice path and not into the lips, and so you don't get sibilance. There's a lot of good things about it.
I want to ask you about the sound utility position. It seems that it's evolved from an entry-level position to one where there's a lot more expectation, from placing microphones on actors to working as an additional boom operator. How have you seen the utility position progress over the years?
Obviously, my first job, I was a sound PA, and I knew nothing. But I learned really quickly how to do playback. I learned how to run cable. I learned a bunch of stuff. And all those things, I think, are really handy to have. When Jean Carroll started working with us, she could boom and do a lot of that stuff, which really took a lot of the pressure off. And again, eliminates the overlapping problem largely. She also would deal with stuff like, you know, Comtex and those sort of things that otherwise are really distracting. If you're, and walkies even. I did a lot of jobs with Lee when he owned walkies, with the days when a lot of mixers owned walkies. And, you know, you'd be there trying to rehearse a scene and trying to figure out where the boom was and all that kind of stuff. And there'd be people coming over saying, my battery's dead, what do I do? You know, to which, you know, you say, well, have you tried putting on a new battery? And that ends up being a big part of your day, whether you're mixing or booming. So for those side tasks, you know, a utility is really great. But also, as you pointed out, now utility, for me, is always a second boom. Most of the day, they're responsible for, you know, finding and eliminating background noise and for dealing with headsets for the directors and producers and whatnot. And they do so much more. There's so much more paperwork and deliverables. And when timecode came in, suddenly somebody has to be there, you know, to jam timecode everywhere and to maintain the slates. It's now a really complicated, skilled position that, you know, if I tried to come into that as a PA like I did originally, I don't know how I would have managed it. It certainly would have annoyed, you know, the rest of the crew that I didn't know how to do those things, no matter how fast you learn. And the technology changes so fast now that, you know, you may know how to jam a slate now, but, you know, next week there's going to be a different kind of a sync box that's the size of a penny and, you know, and charges, you know, through radioactive isotopes or something. I don't know what, but, you know, somebody's got to learn how to do that and then figure out the adapters that attach that to the slate. So it's a very skilled job. And sometimes for me, if it's really simple playback, I'll do it. If I can't, because it's a complicated scene, the utility can do it, because playback's gotten a lot easier than it used to be. Gotten more complicated and easier. And sometimes you need a fourth person for playback. And so many of the utility people I have worked with have been so great. I worked for many, many shows with Kay Colvin, who was not only a great utility, but a very fun person to be around. She liked to knit in her spare time when things were slow. And I had these headsets that were cheap headsets that we used for Comtex, and the earpieces would wear out. And so she started knitting these little covers for the earpieces. And then people started saying, well, can I have one, but I want it in yellow. And the executive producer wanted his made out of like mohair. It became a whole thing. I still have those. She was hugely instrumental in my career, because she made everybody else feel really comfortable around the sound department. And then I have worked for many, many years with Kelly Doran, another utility person, who also, my career was possible because Kelly worked so hard in making everything work, in keeping the equipment working and keeping us working, in finding background noise, in coming up to me, you know, very discreetly and saying, you know, wouldn't that be better if they were walking on rugs? Why, yes, it would be. What a great, you know, and then she'd go out and do that. And, you know, she would do so many things behind the scenes. She, at some point, you know, she didn't even have to ask me. She would go in there and she would set up acoustical things to make things work, and was a great boom operator. That's her primary career now, is as a boom operator. But she still worked for me because we liked working with each other. So she was a big factor also in people who wouldn't otherwise pay any attention to the sound department. They suddenly appreciate, here is this person who's making sure that, you know, everything I need is here, that I can hear. Boy, the number of people that Kelly and I and Kay and others, you know, we would welcome visitors to the set and get them a chair and get them headsets and tell them what's going on. You know, Steven Spielberg came to the set and he, you know, he left one of his children at the sound cart and I let them do the studio bells. You know, it's all those things kind of help, you know, keep your career going. I do have one more thing that I'd sort of like to say. It's, you know, it's a little bit of blowing my own horn, but also other people's. You know, in my career at various times, I've worked with a number of people, Scott Clements and Put Cusack, who were early in their careers and are now established mixers. And when I started working with Scott and Pud, they were probably not even utilities at that point. They were almost, Pud was a sound PA. Scott, I think, was legitimately a third already at that point and knew a lot of stuff. But I'm very happy that those people got into sound, that I worked with them earlier on in their careers, and that they pursued it and they did really well. And also Steve Bowerman, who, like me, boomed for many, many years with the same mixer. And then, you know, as we say, sat down. And he sat down to 14 years on NCIS, which was a great career opportunity for him. He then had a really good, successful career as a mixer, which he really enjoyed. And he played a big part in making my career successful. And I like to think that us working together helped launch him into his own career. And it was very good. There's other people like, on Walk the Line, we had Matt Andrews, and his specialty was that he was also one of the studio engineers who recorded the songs for the album, which we did at the same time that we did the rehearsals and the recordings for playback. So he knew where all the tracks were. He'd already worked with all the performers. He had a really good relationship with everybody, and they trust him because he was a studio engineer. So the other thing that we did was we came into the movie a couple of weeks early, which was supposed to be for scouting, but instead it ended up being music rehearsals. And so we spent, you know, a couple of weeks with the cast and got them used to earwigs, got them used to the live stuff that we wanted to do, you know, all set up so they could hear the tracks as they had to be in the movie, which was different than what they'd recorded for the album. So at that point, they had a relationship with Matt. He didn't want to. He didn't want to be in the movie business. He was happy being a studio engineer. We kind of scrounged him up because we needed somebody who could do playback for us. And he ended up doing years and years of complicated Pro Tools playback for the movie and television industry, and was great at it. But it was never his first love, and now he works full-time at a vintage recording studio here where he spends every day recording on 2-inch tape, you know, with all analog stuff, and I admire that a lot. I think he had no love for the film industry, but he was good at it, and now he's gone back to doing what he really likes.
For music playback on set, where are you personally drawing that line of when you say, I can do this, or utility can do this, or let's bring in a fourth person? I mean, fourth person's a planning thing.
Yeah, sometimes it's planning. Sometimes you don't know what's going to happen. And there's been more than a few times where I've needed a playback person, didn't have one. There's been the rare occasion that I hired a playback person and they didn't get to do anything because it turned out it wasn't necessary. But that's not because I played back in their stead. I wouldn't do that. But because it turned out we didn't do playback that day. But you can sort of tell. I mean, if you see something really complicated coming up, or you know that there's going to be multiple tracks that have to be managed, if you know it's going to, for some reason, it has to be in Pro Tools. I can use Pro Tools really, really basically, but I wouldn't want to count on that. And honestly, a lot of the playback that I do when it's just me, I'm playing back from a laptop or even an iPhone or an iPod, in the iPod days with an iPod, because it's all synchronous. And that's easy. You're just pushing a button and it just plays the same track over and over again. But if there's a lot of cue points, definitely I want a playback person. What we discovered on Oh Brother, and we did have a playback person for about half the movie, is that once Ethan learned that I could edit the music, he wanted music edits. And, you know, that was, you know, I keep saying back in those days, I feel like I'm a dinosaur, but, you know, at that time, we had the most modern technology available, which was this thing from 360 Systems called a shortcut that was made for editing for radio stations. And it would actually show you a waveform, and there were hard buttons for editing. And we used it a lot because it was instant playback. We could put all the music for the movie in this one device and just open the case and take it out. And you could set up a bunch of cue points and it would play back. You know, if they say, okay, pick it up at the second verse, you could do that. Before that, all you could do is mark the tape with grease pencil and hope for the best. But once that technology comes into play, people want to use it. And they'll come saying, hey, can we do that? But can we play it at 22% faster or whatever? And then suddenly somebody has to know what they're doing. In the case of Walk the Line to start, and then a number of other movies, we'd get tracks that were recorded the day before, and they'd come in as full-width Pro Tools sessions. And so Matt Andrews, who did playback with me, he had a big Pro Tools setup in his hotel room, so he could narrow the session down to the four tracks or whatever it was he had on set. And then on set, he could edit and add tracks or reduce tracks. And we did a lot of overdubs live on set, because he could, because he was a studio guy. And that was incredibly useful to the movie and different than playback I could do for myself. And sometimes, you know, I know on Buster Scruggs, there was a scene where there was a terrible storm coming and the whole crew had to bug out, and they had one shot left, which was, you know, Buster on a horse riding up through a canyon, and he had to sing to track. And so that was just me, you know, with my phone playing the track through a battery-powered speaker, walking backwards next to the horse. And then as soon as we were done with the scene, we all ran before the flooding started. So, you know, sometimes you want to do playback yourself. Though I guess ultimately I could have had the playback guy do that, and I wouldn't have had to take the chance of being in the flood. But it just occurs to me now I could have done that.
Going back to the early part of your career, how were you guys approaching musical films then?
Well, again, having worked with, you know, Alan on a number of shows that are musical, and with Lee, you know, I had this idea of what you could do to playback, and then when you could not use playback, when you could record live. And so when I had my first real musical to mix, which was Oh Brother, I went in early during the recording sessions to see what they were doing and got to know T-Bone Burnett really well. And we were able to discuss during the recording sessions, hey, we could do this live, or, you know, maybe we can do this to playback, or could we record live vocals on this? And we kind of sketched out what was possible, and then we carried through in the movie. You know, I always like to get the vocals live. Sometimes you can't do the instrumental live because it's really hard to cut with the different phrasings between the instruments and the voice. So we used a lot of earwigs early on. But we also did a lot of completely live music with no guide. And I think in that movie, we ended up doing one or two tracks that were just straight playback because they were people who didn't normally sing. You know, they didn't want to be recorded, so we used partial playback. But anybody who could sing, we recorded them live. And if there was a band, I mean, almost all of these were existing Americana groups that, you know, performed all over the country. So it was, you could just say, okay, now play this, and they would play it. And it was usually only took one take, but if it took two takes, they were pretty consistent and easy to cut between takes.
How much is there a discussion where, from a post-production music point of view, they're looking at the instrumentation and what they would need later, and you're looking at it from maybe the script or what the filming locations or situations might be, and is that, when those might not seem compatible, what...
Oh, they were never compatible. It was always an impossible situation, and it was always very, very difficult to get a microphone in. And, you know, if you think of singing as dialogue, you know, it's always hard to get the microphone to make the dialogue exactly how you want it, but you find a way to do it, and you find a way to quiet as much of the background down as you can. So it really became about, if you need earwigs, how could you hide them? Or how could you give enough level to make the person comfortable? Or if you could just feed, you know, a click track or a rhythm track or something to keep it consistent. But, you know, I approach it just the way that I approach dialogue. And on most, but not all, the musicals I've done, there wasn't really... I mean, T-Bone was the music supervisor. He did the pre-record sessions. He would help in processing the music afterwards for the movie. But he wasn't always on the set, and he wasn't the one who said, hey, let's do it this way or that way. That was either, you know, in the case of Oh Brother, the Coens, particularly Ethan, who would say, hey, can you move this verse to where that verse is? And can you cut this or change that? And, you know, we figure out a way to do that. But almost all the rest of the decisions were mine, and I had to kind of figure out what was going to work and what wasn't. In the case of Oh Brother, it was particularly challenging because, you know, we were shooting mostly in southern Mississippi. We never had sound with dailies. There was no cutting room. So nobody really listened to the sunk sound until we were done shooting and the Coens had gone off to take a brief 2-week vacation after production. And once they got back, that was really the first time anybody heard anything and figured out whether it worked or not. And I guess, wow. I guess either the planning worked, or more likely, I got really lucky.
That's great.
In later movies, I mean, the same sort of thing happened on Walk the Line, which is, it was also T-Bone, but T-Bone was not on the set. And we just figured out as we went. And at one point, somebody came in and said, you know, I'm going to be the supervising sound editor. And we had a long talk about how to do things. And then it turned out they weren't the person that was hired. And really, I didn't get to meet anybody in post-production until almost the end of the mix, which was kind of horrifying to me. Normally, I like to know the post-production people way up front, the picture editor and the sound editors and mixers, because then they can sort of help to determine what we need. That wasn't the case. I mean, Joel and Ethan were cutting their movies, and so I could talk to them about what they needed sound-wise, but they certainly weren't cutting or mixing the sound. And as I worked with them more, I got to know Skip Livesay really well, and so then he and I could talk about some of those things up front.
Has your approach to mixing changed over the years? Are you having to deal with more cameras now?
Well, I've been very fortunate that I've worked with directors who recognize what they lose by shooting multiple cameras at the same time. I mean, they don't just lose the ability to have a tightly mic'd dialogue. They also lose accurate eye lines. They lose a lot of performance. Everybody feels more rushed. I mean, there's a lot of bad things about shooting with multiple cameras beyond sound. And so mostly the people I work with don't use more than one camera unless there's stunts or some unusual situation. The exception sometimes is live music because it's very hard to cut between multiple takes. And so those scenes sometimes become a challenge. But, you know, we found a way around it. You know, doing Inside Llewyn Davis, the opening scene is all live. And, you know, a lot of it is close up with a handheld camera 2 inches away from Llewyn's face. And then a lot of it is from the back of the room. And so we had, you know, we had a boom always. We had plant mics inside the stage mics. We had overhead plant mics. And we had, you know, big room mics. And so I could adjust at my cart to approximate the perspective. Again, because we had multiple tracks being recorded, I could record them all at the same time and then let Skip decide later on. But I was just in a discussion the other day about how important mix tracks are. And it used to be when you mixed, that was it. Your track was the track. You know, in post-production, they could checkerboard and they could change the dynamics a little bit. But pretty much, if you decided to use a boom instead of a radio, that choice was baked in. Now there's a lot more flexibility for the post people. But regardless, the mix track itself lives through dailies, it lives through picture editorial, it lives through the beginning of sound editorial. It's often what's used for spotting for ADR. And so it's a really important track. And so I want that to sound right. And sometimes that means adjusting how it sounds to suit picture better. So even if I know it sounds good, you know, with the microphone here, if it sounds okay with the microphone 3 feet farther back because that works for that scene, then I have to adjust for that. It's harder now because a lot of people have moved to a lot of radio mics and they're used to this sound that you get with, you know, microphone like that sounds like, you know, your head is on their chest. And people now are used to that and it's hard to move them away from it. But if they hear a good mix track that sounds good and is intelligible and it sounds natural for the movie and nobody has to later on add reverb or whatever to it, then, you know, it'll stay for a long time, often, you know, to the screen.
When you say people are getting used to the wires, are you talking about up-and-coming sound professionals? Are you talking about directors? Talking about post-production?
I think
all the above.
The people who I have the biggest problem with are directors and ADs. Because the directors like to not have to stop and the ADs don't want to wait for anything. And so they always say, well, wire everybody, just don't worry about finding a place for the boom operator, just wire it. They don't realize that that's probably going to take them more time in the long run, and it can sound worse. So if I'm doing a TV pilot or something like that, I'll always wire everybody because it's not worth having the argument about, you know, we don't need it, we'll do it later if we need it. But on a feature film, if I don't have to wire the actors, I won't, and I don't carry a lot of radios. They're a great tool. You know, I started with Vegas, which, if you're familiar with, it's a very big, very crappy sounding radio with very poor reception. It was state of the art when I had them. And now I have much, much better wireless that sounds really good and doesn't drop out. But the microphone's in the wrong place. So if you can avoid it, that's good.
Mentally, what are you feeling when you know that the mix is working? I mean, especially something complicated with like Llewyn Davis, where you had like multiple tracks or multiple mics going. What's going through your head when you know things are good?
I have a tendency when that particular setup is done to think, hey, what was wrong with that? Because I expect there to be problems and there aren't, or it works. It's relief. I think there's a little bit of pride in it, but it's mostly relief. And oftentimes when you're in the heat of the battle, you don't recognize that whether things are working or not. And it's really nice to be done and either know that you've got it or play it back and say, hey, that actually sounds pretty good. They can use that part, which is often a surprise to me. I often go through a whole scene fighting background noise or fighting complicated dialogue. And then when it's all done, thinking, well, that can't possibly work. That fade was late. There was that car in the background. And it's very hard to judge in the middle of the scene. And afterwards, you can listen to it back and know, hey, that's going to work. That is a really good feeling. You know, the opposite, of course, is that you do your best that you can. And then you realize when you play it back, it's completely unusable. And that's always sad. And sometimes it gets used anyway. And you have to live with it. If you figure the post-production people are going to be your friends and cover for it, or they feel it's going to work and, you know, they have another set of ears and they can decide that something that you think is completely impossible is fine.
In pre-production, from script to shooting, do you have anything you're looking for or guideposts in preparation?
Yeah, I'd be the first to admit I'm a terrible script reader. I'll read it. The first time I read through, I'm really looking for, are there telephone calls? Is there singing? What in this movie requires special equipment? Is there any scene that's going to require additional personnel? That's sort of my first pass. My second pass, which I learned late in my career, is how many of these scenes take place at night? And what month are we going to shoot this? That comes second. And then I try to read it for content. And that's the part that I'm not good with knowing what the movie's going to be like when it's done. Some movies that I've, like comedies, I've laughed hysterically reading through them. But oftentimes I don't recognize where the humor is because so many of the scripts I've read have been Joel and Ethan scripts where they've got the picture in their head. They don't have to prove anything to anybody. So you don't really always understand what they're going for until you're in pre-production. They're talking about how the scene's going to play out, or you're on the set and you realize, oh, wait a second, that's hilarious. And that's really good. And what's nice about that is it means every day is an adventure in appreciating the movie itself and not just the work. But getting back to planning, I do try to read through and find out what are going to be the challenges. And particularly on a musical, there's a very long period where I'm trying to figure out, not by myself, but also with the music supervisor, the director, sometimes the producer, how are they expecting this to play? Is this going to be playback? Is this going to be live? What can we do? What can we not? And we always do try to plan. But I also always try to have an alternative. You know, what happens if the actor's sick that day? What happens if whatever? So you always want to try to have a playback track of some kind. And then when you can, you try to do it live. And sometimes even that pre-production period doesn't answer the question. Every once in a while, like on Walk the Line, we knew there was a big section that took place in a recording studio with three or four songs that were done, and it was going to require a whole variety of different ways to make it work. And that actually required a lot of planning up front. And you can see that when you read the script. Mm. But I learned some stuff like, you know, Gary Alper, when we were doing that very first movie, Living Proof, there was a scene where in the movie, the band is rehearsing, and then somebody comes in and disturbs the whole thing, and the thing falls apart. And, you know, then what do? You have to pick a place to end the playback, or you have to always have the band fall. And you have to, somewhere, somebody has to think of the idea of making a recording of a band falling apart. And that isn't something that always comes to mind. So there's a lot of the stuff that goes on. And I think my favorite part is going into the recording studio when things are being made and saying, hey, this is great. This sounds beautiful. But for the purposes of the movie, you're going to want these people on separate tracks. For purposes of the movie, this has to have a place where it falls apart, but you also need to have a full version because maybe you're going to want to use it as score, or maybe the full song is going to play over the end credits or whatever. And so those are things that I like to think about and can help suggest during the recording session phase.
Are you having to push for that involvement, or are they pretty open to inviting you from the start?
It depends. On one movie I can think of, I knew they were recording. I asked if I could go. They were happy to have me go as long as I didn't charge them money to be there. On other movies, I've said I really need to be there, and I would appreciate if you would fly me in to all of this recording. And on at least one of them, I wasn't invited. I went anyway. They hadn't decided to hire me yet, but I knew the people who were involved, and I said, do you mind if I sit in for some of this? And then I ended up being there the whole time and spending that time mapping out how the movie should go, even though I hadn't been hired yet. I guess that was nervy, but it paid off.
When you say mapping it out, what are you mapping out?
Well, in that particular case, you know, there were like 16 tracks, and figuring out which are live, which are playback, which are a hybrid where the vocals are live, whether some of the instruments are played live and some of them are not, those kind of things. So little is completely straight playback, and not everything could be totally live. So there's often got to be some line drawn, and it's different for every song, every setting the song is played in. Llewyn Davis, we did some of everything, but it was mostly live, and it really helped. You know, one of the songs, The Death of Queen Jane, that's one take with a long camera push that involved, I mean, from a mixing perspective, it goes from a super wide shot to a close-up and then back to a super wide shot. And I certainly wanted the close-up on the boom, and so we had to make a whole plan how that was going to work, but we knew we could do it. We wanted to do it live because there was not going to be any issue in cutting because there were no cuts in it. We did some other songs live in that there were cuts in, and some of them were really hard for them in post. Most of them were not, just because Oscar Isaac was so consistent in how he played and sang. You could always find a spot that matched to cut in. But again, every song is different.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a history with music that predates all these musicals in your career?
That's interesting because that there's sort of two stories to how my career started. And one is a story I've already told, which is, you know, running into this person completely as a fluke and then getting this job. But, you know, the other part of it is that my father's a musician, a violinist, and when I was young, was a music professor. And so as part of that, he owned a woolen sack recorder, a giant silver beast that we could occasionally go to his office and play with. And sort of as an offspring, he bought, you know, little portable recorders as they became affordable on a professor's salary. But through my entire life, he was playing in orchestras or in concerts in a quartet or by himself. So I was very much exposed to that music, which was mostly classical. Then when we moved to Nashville, and as he got out of the professor business, he was playing mostly in the recording studios as a sideman, and he was doing music of every kind. He was doing commercial jingles. He was doing rock and roll music, country music, you name it. He was on it. And I went to a number of sessions, and I asked him many times to teach me music theory, which he certainly attempted to do. But he did not want me to become a musician. He said, you know, all growing up as a small child, he'd want to go and play stickball in the street, and instead he was carrying his violin. And even though it turned into a very lucrative career for him, he would have much rather been a baseball player. So he wanted something different for me. And my mother, thinking I should learn an instrument, she sent me in for classes, and I took piano lessons and I took violin lessons. And finally, when I was going to be in orchestra in high school, I guess, there was nothing I really either wanted to play or was good at. And so I said, how about the tuba? I think my father suggested it. He said, how about the tuba? I think he meant it as a joke. And they scrounged up a tuba from some attic somewhere, which, you know, I played probably for 2 years, all of which led me to be able to read music a little bit, to understand music theory a little bit, to understand rhythm and melody and all that kind of stuff. Not as much as so many other sound mixers who I know who are in bands or who are huge music fans. You know, when we have a CAS meeting and you look at the background of somebody's office, you know, where I've got all these weird things in the background, they've got guitars. They almost always have like 12 or 15 guitars and different things, and I can't play a guitar. I learned once, but like the banjo and the tuba and all these other things, I could play them at one time and not anymore. All of that proved to be useful, like in O Brother, where, you know, I'm looking at a waveform and trying to figure out where to make a cut to move a verse down, you know, 12 bars. I had to be able to figure out where the bars were, looking at a waveform and not at bars. And I had to be able to know the timing of the beat and all that kind of stuff to make a musical cut, which turned out to be a very useful thing to be able to do. I don't do it as well as, say, Matt Andrews or Mark Agostino do, but I did it serviceably in that movie. And those cuts, you know, outlived me because they're cuts that I made in performances that then were given and used on film. So they were good enough. I like recording live music a lot. And so the movies that I do that have music in them, I probably push harder than I should to have them be live. And I'm very happy with the way they come out as a result. And maybe that's why people offer me those jobs, because they know that's what I do. On the other hand, some of those jobs, I don't think they intended to be live, and somehow they became that way. I was very specifically told by one of the producers for Walk the Line, look, this isn't a musical. And so I tried to treat it like a straight dialogue movie, but there's just 14 tracks in that movie, and they're all multiple musicians, and, you know, it's a musical. People are singing.
Yeah. You have this interesting background in theater, and you own a theater, the Dark Horse Theater. What does that involvement look like? What does that look like for you?
Well, when I was 12, I was like a bit player in a children's theater here in Nashville, and I continued to be a performer here for until I went to college, and then less so in college. But I always had an interest in theater. When I went to college, my idea was I was going to do theater design, not set design, but actually design the theaters themselves. That had been my goal, but it did not happen. But my wife was always involved in theater. She worked for the professional company here. She's an equity member. And when the big company that was based here, the performers for that company really wanted to get outside of doing, you know, plays that are done all the time, you know, not to single anything out, but, you know, if you can do Oklahoma or West Side Story, it's been done many, many times. They wanted to do more edgy stuff. And so we started looking for a place where they could perform that was smaller, that was much less expensive, and that there'd be the freedom to do whatever they wanted, no matter how weird it was. And at the same time, and this is the weird intersectionality with the movie business, I was working with the people that did the Ernest commercials, Studio Productions, and we did, I don't know, I counted them at one point, I got up to 6,000 commercials I'd done with Ernest. There were probably more. we would do sometimes 30 in a day. And I did a number of the Ernest movies, like the first three or four Ernest movies I ended up boom operating on, which was a really great experience. And during one of those commercials, it turned out that I was looking for a theater space and Studio Productions was looking for a new building to be in. And they said, well, we found a building. It's a former church and it has this huge auditorium that we don't need, you know. And I said, oh, well, I'd need this thing for the theater. And we went into partnership for 30 years. And I actually kind of got my chance at theater design because we had to figure out how to convert the church into a theater, which seems like it should be simple, but was not. But it worked and it's worked for decades. So I occasionally will direct there. I don't think I've ever performed in anything there. My wife's directed there. My father wrote a play that was performed there. And that's just sort of what I do with any earnings I have from the film industry is sink them into live theater, where they don't last long.
But I'm sure you get a lot out of it.
Yeah. And, you know, I like to say that the performers get to put on a play and the audience gets to see it. And I get to go there and then unclog the sinks and toilets when the whole thing's over. That's largely my role in that building.
You also currently serve as the business agent for IATSE 492. What interested you in being involved with your union?
Well, in my whole career, there were always issues that affected, you know, the quality of life, meal breaks and overtime and, you know, the time to sleep and being paid correctly. They're just part of life on the set. And I always found it interesting to see how those things were managed. And oftentimes it was very hard to get somebody to intervene. There's a lot of representatives for the union now who come to set a lot, but that wasn't always the case. And sometimes you have an issue that doesn't really come up to the level where the business rep has to come in. So I always got involved in that, and I always kept a copy of the contract with me so I could see, you know, how things were supposed to work. And so that was a big piece of it. But the other piece was, you know, I started my career in Nashville, and there was not a sound or studio mechanics local here. And we really needed one. And I found that when I was trying to get started in my career, I wasn't part of the stagehands local that put a lot of crew on films that came through here. I couldn't join there, but I wanted to do these movies. And it seemed like the solution was to get all the studio mechanics together and form our own local, which we did. And so I was a big part of that, along with Daryl Wilson. We petitioned the IA. They sent a representative down. They established a local. And then I've been in a leadership position in that local ever since. So I did it for largely selfish reasons. But the more I've done it, the more important I think it is. And so I sort of stick with that. And it's always been relatively compatible with my sound career, because even though I did it so that I could get into the business in Nashville, I've only done maybe two projects in Nashville since the local started. Almost all my work is out of town. And if you're a local business agent who works in a craft, it's really difficult, you know, because if you're working, you're sort of beholden to the producer. If you fight the producer, maybe you ruin your job opportunities. And so as long as I keep the two things separate, and most of my work is in Los Angeles or New York or New Mexico, then it isn't a problem if I, you know, end up having to strike a commercial in Nashville or something. The longer my career goes on, the more I find that there is overlap and I end up running into the same people in my career that I do in the union. And that's a little bit problematic. It was really awkward on Walk the Line, because I had left an acting business agent in my place because Walk the Line was actually shooting in Tennessee. And I made a big point of not telling anybody in the production that I worked with the union at all. But I ended up hearing so many conversations on the scout bus between the producers and the ADs and everybody thinking, well, what can we get away with here? And can we do that? Can we do this? And I'm just sitting there listening to it, and I don't want to say anything. I figure if there's a problem, I'll let the assistant business agent deal with it. And I guess about 4 days into a week of scouting, they found out and they looked at me sheepishly and they apologized, and it was fine because I got to be friends with the producers and it was all good after that. But they would come to me and they would say, hey, what about this or that? And I would say, you know, you need to call the assistant business agent. I'm not here as a business agent and I don't want to do that. In the same way, I often have producers who, when they come to Nashville or anywhere in Tennessee to shoot, they'll say, hey, we need to make a deal with you. And by the way, we know you're a mixer. Would you like to do this movie? And there's kind of a quid pro quo that's being set up, and I don't want any part of that. And I always say, I will not work for you. I'm sorry. Let's make this deal as a separate thing. I can think of only two instances where I worked with a producer I made a deal with, and one of those was Walk the Line, and that was all pretty much set up separate for me. And the other one was in the TV series Nashville, and I only worked for a total of 6 hours out of a 6-year shooting schedule, so I figured that was okay.
And of course, you are also currently the CAS president. What spurred your decision to run for that position?
I joined the board about 3 years ago. I found it a really interesting organization. I'd always, even before I was in the business, I'd always see the initials after people's names and wonder what that was about. And so I really wanted to be part of the organization. And then once I got on the board, it seemed to be that there was a need to be filled. And I talked to other people about doing it. And there were several people who ran who would have been good, but they wanted me to run too. And I did. And I got elected. And I have to say, it's been an interesting challenge. And I certainly didn't expect that my first year was going to be the year with a 6-month strike, you know, with a compressed award season, with all of these things that we're trying to figure out. But, you know, my work with the union had sort of given me a sense of how you set up an organization. And so there were certain organizational things that I felt like I could bring in just to start with. And I've done some of those things. But the organization's been around for 60 years. It didn't absolutely need me, but it needed somebody. And there I was. I also really had a hard time turning down the possibility of working with Lee again. And even though I wasn't boom operating for him, and even though it wasn't a movie, we always had a great relationship. And so it was really fun to do that.
That's great. What do you see for the future for CAS?
I don't know. And I can't really speak for the organization. I know the industry is changing. There's a lot of post-production mixers who also edit. And so having two separate organizations to represent those people has become more and more awkward. I don't know what the solution to that is. The world of gaming has become really big. And, you know, I used to think that gaming was done largely, the sound was done by algorithm, and you'd program the sound in and it played when the person pushed the right button. And it turns out there's much more to it than that. Just in the few conversations I've had with gaming mixers, you know, they said to me that up to 10 hours in a typical modern video game is shot like a movie. It's shot live. It goes through the whole post-production process, editing and mixing, just like a movie would be. It's not at all different from a movie. And so it's going to be harder and harder to draw the line there too, particularly as so many movies turn more to be video game-like and video games get to be more movie-like. There's some convergence there that's going to have to be dealt with. I don't know how the CAS is going to deal with that. We're moving slowly towards some kind of solution, but it's not going to be easy. And I'll say it's still, you know, there's still a little bit of a split between the people who do television and people who do movies, and you want to try to balance that out. And so then to try to do that also with people in other positions and other industries is going to be a challenge. You know, right now we're just focused on putting together a really good award show.
What does CAS represent to you?
Well, you know, I come from the movie world, so I'm one of those people who's having a hard time putting all these different disciplines together, and I come from production and not from post. One of the things I would love to see the CAS do, because it has both post mixers and production mixers, is form better communications between those two disciplines to have people understand better what the different people who contribute to the soundtrack do, why production people are important, why post-production people are important, and to not discount any member of the chain who's doing a job that contributes tremendously to the overall movie, not just its sound, but to the performances and to how the audience feels about it. And that's every single person has a contribution to be made in those areas. And I want to see them all be appreciated, not just by the broader industry and by the audience, but also amongst themselves, because I still find places where the post-production people don't understand what the contribution of the production people are and vice versa. And I'd like to fix that. I also see it being more of an international business than it ever was. And so I'd like to see more international outreach. We already have members across the globe, but it'd be nice to be able to incorporate them into more activities, since most of the things that we do are Los Angeles based. And as somebody who doesn't live in Los Angeles, I'm particularly sensitive to that topic. I've been, lucky is the wrong word, but since I joined the board, all of our meetings have been virtual. So I haven't had to fly out to Los Angeles every month to go. One day I will, and it's so much nicer to see people in person. But I also realize how impossible it is if you're somebody who has a whole career in New York or in San Francisco or in Vancouver or London. I mean, there's big concentrations of people in all those places, and they don't get to participate in so many CAS events, and I'd like to see that change.
In 2022, in reaction to changes in how the Academy Awards was to broadcast the Best Sound Award, you chose to resign. Do you mind telling that story?
Yeah, it's a dumb story, but, you know, I don't want to sound thankless, but I did go to the Oscars several times as a nominee, and I was kind of surprised at how certain categories were treated and, you know, what a hurry they were to give those awards away and how easy it was if you said, well, wait a second, you know, I'd rather sit with my loved one while I'm waiting to hear than to be having to be moved around the auditorium, whatever that year's system was to make it faster. So I was already kind of wound up about making sure that sound people were treated respectfully. And then when they made the decision to not even give our award away on the air, after we'd already had to compromise in so many ways to keep the award on the air, I found that very aggravating. And it was done in a very undemocratic way with very little communication. And the only impact I seemed to be able to have on it was to leave the Academy. And I wasn't the only one. And I wasn't even the first one, but I threatened to quit, and I called the Academy, and I said I want to quit, and I told everybody I was quitting, because that had been my intention, and I tried, and then they never removed me. And so I called back, and I said, look, I want to leave the Academy. They said, well, this is really complicated, and can you wait until after the awards? And so ultimately, I did everything that I could to leave. I wasn't able to get out, so the point was made, the story was out. But I didn't have to rejoin because they never effectively took me out. So I don't know how much of an impact I made, but there were a lot of us who were very unhappy about that decision, and they reversed it. And now the award is given live on the air again, although they have reduced the number of movies that win a Sounder Award, and I have a personal issue with that. But there's reasons why they did that, and you know, I'm just one opinion. It's interesting. I don't want to disparage the Academy or its members. I'm a huge fan of the Academy. I've been watching the Academy Awards since I was a kid. So I don't want to say anything negative about it. That being said, one of the things I like about this Cinema Audio Society is that you're being judged entirely by your peers, and they have a better appreciation for what does make good sound and who contributed what. Not entirely, but they have a better sense of it. And so, you know, as is often said tritely, being nominated is the main thing. So if you're nominated by your peers in the Academy, and then your name is put forward by in front of 10,000 members who may or may not understand your craft, whether it's acting or whether it's sound or what have you, and they vote for their own reasons. And it is not necessarily an accurate reflection of the overall best in a particular area. I don't think it's done out of a sense of meanness or misunderstanding or that they're not legitimate votes. I just think it's harder to pick somebody. And the CAS award, I think, often goes to shows that are recognized, again, by your peers, because there is no much larger group that then gets a vote on top of it. So that's a good thing about the CAS. It's a challenge with the Academy. But I understand how it works, and all the members get a say in everything. And as a member, if I didn't get to vote for some of those other crafts, you know, I would be very disappointed. I always vote in cinematography. I have a good sense of that. I've been on set for 40 years, and there's people who I really respect, and I think they are deserving of awards. But I could also see if you're a cinematographer, you would think, well, the opinion of a sound guy doesn't mean that much because they have no idea what it took to get that shot. Because ultimately, for all of us, for most entertainment, if you've done your job right, the audience doesn't think about your job. They might think about it afterwards, and it might be talked about in the reviews, but nobody's watching the movie and thinking, wow, this dialogue sounds really crisp and clear. They'll notice if they can't hear it. They'll notice if the cinematography is drab. They might even get a sense of energy in a movie that might come from camera movement or something that's part of the cinematographer's world, but they don't know why they feel that way about it. This is one of the reasons why within the CAS, one of the things I want to do is education. So I want the post-production people to know what the production people deal with and what makes a good production track. And I want the production people to know why the post people do what they do and what makes their work good. And getting back to the awards briefly, the reason that I believe they combined the two Academy Awards for sound was because most of the time, both the editing and mixing awards were going to the same movie, whether they should have been or not. And they may have been selected by different people within the branch, but when it comes right down to it, when the voting comes, the sound is good or the sound's not good, and maybe they just say, well, that movie sounded great, and we want to give it an award. We might as well give it both awards. I don't know, but, you know, I got nominated for Walk the Line, and the same year, King Kong won the award, and they were both really good soundtracks for entirely different reasons, and it's just a sad thing that they had to go up against each other. And, you know, maybe there should be separate awards rather than for mixing and editing. Maybe there should be awards for, you know, musicals versus effects heavy movies. And I think that may have been sort of the idea originally between those two awards, but it certainly evolved to something different than that. And that's why it ended up getting combined to one award.
How did you feel when you got those first nominations? I think your first CAS nomination was for Men in Black.
The Men in Black one was interesting because I don't remember how I found out, but I don't recall a phone call from the organization, and the studio was not very involved. And because it was mixed in New York, there was nobody who was sort of present in Los Angeles to push for it. I don't know that anybody was paying attention. I don't know what happened. All I know is that I was nominated. I was really excited to go. And Lee Dichter, who was also nominated, I was always excited to work with him. But it never occurred to me to call the studio. I wouldn't have known who to call to say, hey, you know, where's my hotel room? Where's my airplane ticket? So I flew myself out. I put myself up. And I was very excited to be there and to go. But in retrospect, boy, I missed the boat on that one because, you know, in subsequent years, the awards department at the studios was all about, you know, we're going to fly you out there and you're going to be on a panel to talk about the movie and we're going to press for this and that. And here's your fancy hotel room and here's your limo when you need it. That was very unusual for somebody like me who, you know, I'm lucky if I get a rental car, but it was nice. Once I learned about that, it changed the whole awards season for me. But obviously, I was very thankful to the CAS. It was exciting to be there. And it was fun. And obviously, the first Academy nomination was huge. I'd never been through anything like that before. Every moment of it was, you know, I was wide-eyed and, you know, trying to figure out how things worked.
Did you get a sense while working on any of these films, like Walk the Line, No Country, or True Grit, that you're working on something that might end up being nominated?
Honestly, I've never really been able to think about that. Sometimes I've looked at performances in those movies and said, wow, that's an amazing performance. That's, you know, people are going to take note of that. But I never took the luxury of thinking, hey, I'm doing such a great job that somebody's going to appreciate this work later on. I'm just used to doing the best job I can, and either people appreciate it or they don't. So it's nice when it's recognized.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always funny to me when people list those nominations and awards because it's exciting to have them, but I never expected that, really. I didn't practice my Academy Award speech for my whole career, and thank God I didn't because I never would have gotten a chance to give it.
You mentioned problem solving. And sort of what was the joy, or what's been the joy of the problem-solving aspect of working on set for you?
Joy is an interesting word.
Okay. or interest, maybe.
Yeah.
Or when that comes up.
The satisfaction of meeting a challenge. When I was in college, I became a firefighter and a paramedic. And I'm still friends with those people now. And believe me, I'm getting somewhere with this. And they, you know, there was some picture of me on set. And they said, you know, what is a firefighter doing with all those Pelican cases? And, you know, my response was, like, I'm still doing the same job. It's still carrying around really heavy stuff, setting it up in a panic, and responding to, like, last-minute emergencies. That's really the job. You know, my friend Steve-O used to say, like, being an airline pilot was, you know, hours of intense boredom punctuated by moments of terror. And that's kind of like what being on set is. And I kind of enjoy that. It's the same thing that I liked about firefighting. You never know what you're going to face. You have to go through and do the best job. You know, people's lives don't depend on it, but they would certainly make you believe they did. And you get through it. Everything seems impossible and you get through it. And then, you know, you go home at the end of the day and you say, hey, you know, that worked. Or, you know, rarely, as you were pointing out before, I can go home and say, hey, I made that work. And that's really satisfying. I do like solving problems. I used to make a lot of my own sort of accessory equipment, headphone amps and combiners. And when we were on the Abyss, Lee and I made all of this communications equipment for underwater. That was super satisfying. I do like that part. I like learning new things. Less so now, but it is satisfying to be able to do things when I'm asked. And I've had a whole career where I have either volunteered for or been volunteered for, hey, how are we going to solve this problem? An example is in Wild Wild West again, there's a scene where Ted Levine's character is dead on the floor, and as sort of a gag, he has these like miniature, it's the megaphone part of a Victrola that he's using as a hearing aid. And so when he's lying dead, this thing's sticking up. And a dog comes over and sniffs at him, which is isomorphic to the RCA logo with a dog with its head in the gramophone. Right. And they couldn't figure out how to make the dog do the stunt. And so, you know, I ran out to the truck and I wired up a little tiny speaker and I jammed it in Ted's ear and I ran wires down his neck and we would play whistling noises and stuff that the dog could hear. So when it ran over there, we'd always go, and it was kind of perfect. And those are the kind of things that I'm proud of. It was a problem that it shouldn't have been up to me to solve, but I figured out a way to solve it. Somebody, I just read from somebody was saying, You know, I've been very lucky in my career, but somehow it seems that at the times I became lucky, I was working really hard. So there's some value to that as well.
Yes. Thank you so much. This has been really great. Thank you to Peter Kurland, CES, for taking the time to share his stories.
Looking for more audio-related podcasts to listen to? We're part of the Audio Podcast Alliance, featuring a hand-picked selection of the very best podcasts about sound. Be sure to hear the latest episodes from our friends in the community at audiopodcast.org.